It's the morning show. I'm Shireen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Calls to weaken intellectual property rights for universities and nonprofits that rely on federal funding are raising some alarm bells. Advocates say making that kind of a change could threaten the country's economic competitiveness and perhaps our national security. What would happen if the government ultimately changes the status quo? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Iverson is the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, known as WARF. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Shireen. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How does the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation work? How does it support discovery?
It supports discovery by, we are the what's called a patenting organization, or the Technology Transfer Office for the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And as inventions arise on campus, they come to us and we evaluate whether we can seek patents on those. And if we can, we will file patents. And then it is our job to put those into the hands of people who can translate that into products and out into the world.
The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation was established a long time ago, in 1925. It was the nation's first technology transfer office at a university. How did the foundation come about? Give me a little history here.
Thank you for the question. Quite a remarkable and altruistic move. Dr. Steenbach developed the invention of irradiating foods to enrich it with vitamin D, which was needed to address a disease called rickets, which is a terrible disease. And in the process, what he did is he turned to the university and said, hey, take this invention and seek a patent on it. And let's see if we can commercialize it with the food industry. The university was in no position to do that, kind of didn't know what it was doing, and it refused the idea. And Dr. Steenbach pulled together some cronies, and they formed the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, otherwise known as WARF. We filed a patent on that, and in 1925, we licensed that to Quaker Oats for $1 million.
In 1925? $1 million, that's a lot of money in 1925.
It's a ton of money. You're absolutely right. And he didn't take anything for that. I mean, that is effectively what he did, is he donated this remarkable invention that really addressed this scourge of a disease for this amount of money. And our idea is we take those dollars then and we make grant back to the university to continue the research on campus. So it was really an amazing story.
Wow. We're talking about the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation with WARF CEO Eric Iverson. So share some examples of patented technology created by UW-Madison. Obviously, this, you know, this ultraviolet light irradiation technique is really important, too. What other things are we talking about here?
Well, the campus is remarkable. It is incredibly broad. It's one of the broadest campuses, I suggest, in the entire world, running from the agriculture to the life sciences, engineering, of course, computer sciences. And so you never know on any given day what invention is going to come up, whether it's going to be a healthcare invention or something to help animals or a new crop variety or what have you. And so in any given year, 400 inventions show up at WARF, and we wind up filing patents on about half of those. And I, as I came out of Seattle, I thought, geez, I can't wait to see a lot of the imaging technologies, and as we get into quantum and new motor technologies. And the first time I attended one of our invention disclosure meetings, it was all about new crop varieties, particularly beets and different colors and tastes. I thought, wow, beets, really? I've moved from Seattle to talk about beets and cranberries. Exactly, beets and cranberries. And it is incredibly important to our economy here in Wisconsin and incredibly important for the country and, quite frankly, the world. And the beets, I said, well, what are we going to do with those? Well, Cordon Bleu and other international cooking schools look to Wisconsin for certainly the dairy area, but also new crops that we produce. So it runs the gamut, Shireen.
Wow. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Bayh-Dole Act. This was passed in 1980. It allows universities and other nonprofit research labs to retain intellectual property rights to those technologies that they develop with the help of taxpayer funds. How did the Bayh-Dole Act impact the foundation's research?
Well, it allowed, prior to the Bayh-Dole Act, which was around 1980 or so, mm-hmm. before that, the federal government owned all inventions that had some federal funding behind it. And although thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of new inventions were arising around the country, the federal government only licensed less than 5% of those. It just is not in a capacity to do anything with those inventions. So what Bayh-Dole allowed the universities to do is own the inventions that arise on their campus. And the campuses then across our country, and quite frankly, across the world, have tech transfer offices who take the inventions, put them in the hands of companies to develop products, whether it's for the environment or for health or animal welfare, new crops, et cetera. And as we do that, we receive license fees from the companies. And those license fees go into our investment portfolio, and we make big grants back to the campus each year. Wharf is distinct because we're separate from the campus. We don't report up to the chancellor. We're not state employees. So we have a balance sheet and we make large grants. We provide to the campus upwards of $100 million a year in grant dollars to support the research enterprise. And that is just a fraction, of course, of the $1.3 to $1.5 billion a year this campus generates in research funding. But that's how we do it. We supplement a lot of research grants to campus.
Well, some lawmakers want the Biden administration to expand the Bayh-Dole. They want to improve access to cancer medication and lower its cost. How would it work?
Well, I don't think it should work through the Bayh-Dole Act, to be honest. My life has been spent largely on access to medicines. I worked for years with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I was an early employee there. And I was hired specifically to address the issue of as the Gates said, we're spending billions on developing of vaccines, drugs, diagnostics, new crops even. How do we get those into the hands of the people we care about at the Gates Foundation, the poorest of the poor in the world? And regularly there is attacks on the patents saying, geez, if only there weren't patents, things would be cheaper and we could get them to the people we care about. Mm-hmm. And I traipse around the world doing a lot of stuff with World Health Organization and developing countries. And I fundamentally do not believe that that is the root problem. It is really about how one manages patents and works with a partner to get a product developed. And so what we're hearing now is that that issue has come home to roost in the United States, saying, well, geez, these patents on these drugs mean that these drugs are too expensive. Mm-hmm. And that's just too easy. That's too easy of a soundbite. And I think it is one issue of many that's driving our incredibly too high healthcare system. And drugs are too expensive. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But it is not the patent situation is not a panacea to end that problem, nor is it really the critical problem, in my opinion.
How do you fix that then? I mean, that's probably the $10 million question, right?
You're absolutely right, Shereen. And it, you know, if we knew a quick answer to that problem, we would have done it already, right? Or at least I hope our policymakers would have done it already. And it is just a broad set of issues that, of course, people in Washington, D.C. and people within our own legislature are grappling with all the time. But it is an incredibly complex series of issues. Government certainly has a role. Industry has a significant role. Funding institutions and the insurance industry, they do. That would take us many hours in a radio show, not just a brief one focus on patents.
Well, in March, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Commerce announced this joint effort to review its authority under Bayh-Dole. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, I think people will look at it and debate it. And I think Bayh-Dole itself, it's interesting. They're kind of mucking in an area, trying to squeeze in a component that is, hey, if we don't like the price of a drug, we're going to go in what's called march-in rights, and we're going to take rights to those drugs. We're going to have them made elsewhere and we're going to make them cheaper. That was fundamentally not an aspect of why Bayh-Dole was created. In fact, it was very much not about that, and the legislative history speaks to that. And periodically these debates arise, and right now it's a period of time with this administration. They're looking for ways, and quite frankly, quick ways, which I don't disagree with, I suppose, mm-hmm. To address drug pricing. And patents always seem to be an easy target because they're tangible. One wants to go at this, but I think fundamentally breaking down by Dole Act, which has been enormously successful for this country in trillions of dollars of GDP, hundreds of thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of startup companies. I think trying to get a quick win on a drug pricing issue, attacking a law that has been so fundamentally transformative for our country is just too narrow-minded, in my opinion.
Something that you said just caught my attention. You said march-in rights. Can you explain what that is exactly?
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate the question. The Bayh-Dole Act is effectively says universities, if you give rise to an invention and has some federal funding, any federal funding on it, the university can own it. You can seek a patent on it. But it's your job to put it in the hands of companies or whomever to get it into the marketplace. And if the people who you've licensed the patents to do not, for commercial reasons, just don't get it into the marketplace, and the country feels it needs it for national security or other reason, it can march in and take the rights to put them into somebody else's hands to try to get the product made for the welfare of our citizenry. And what people like to say is, well, geez, that must mean that if the companies aren't making it as broadly available and as cheaply, then maybe the government can march in under that Bayh-Dole Act and take those products and make it more available cheaper. Mm. And that's too narrow of a reading, and specifically wasn't designed for that. The government set this law into motion so that these inventions can be put into the hands of companies. It's about driving industry. It's about driving jobs. It's about driving products into the marketplace. It has nothing to do with the pricing of those products. It's just they want to make sure those products get to the marketplace one way or another.
Eric Iverson is the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. He stays with us. You can call in, too, with your questions and thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue now our discussion on how universities and other nonprofit research labs retain intellectual property rights for the technologies they develop. Eric Iverson is the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You talked a little bit about how the system changed when Bayh-Dole happened. What do you think would happen if the federal government once again owned all the patents resulting from the research it funded?
Oh, I would think that we would go back to the pre-Bayh-Dole, right? I mean, that's your point.
Yeah.
And I think the federal government, having the federal government be the repository of thousands of inventions, the infrastructure that would have to be created at the federal government to do this kind of job, understanding the various technologies as well as the geographies, I think things would just go back to the way they were pre-Bayh-Dole. It's all been disseminated out to the individual universities who know their technologies best, and it also creates a much larger workforce to address these things. So it wouldn't be the right answer. I think it would bring the screeching halt to things.
So you don't think that the federal government now would be any more able to take this on than they were, 40 plus years ago?
Well, they have their own technology transfer office already for internal research that they conduct within the federal labs. So they have their hands full already doing their own research and inventions. So, yeah, I think we'd just be compounding that on that in a very dramatic fashion. I think they're best placed within the universities in which the inventions arise, for sure.
And federal grants help pay for research. So if a technology is made possible by taxpayer funding, should the public have paid access to the end product? That's a question for you.
Yeah, and that is kind of the question, right? And that's what people pose. And it's, and I understand and I can appreciate very much that point. A lot of the inventions, however, are quite are nascent when we receive them. They're just, they're ideas, they're hatched. And sure, there might be a researcher who has been in the lab and she's been working on something for years and perhaps even received millions of dollars of federal money. But once that invention gets put into the hands, for example, the drugs, because we were talking about drugs earlier, by the time a company, maybe it goes through a startup and you get venture funding and then you get a big pharma that gets into it, the federal government money might be a few million dollars that went into that very early. But by the time that drug gets to market, it's $400 or $500 million worth of expense. Mm-hmm. And in order to justify those expenses, whether to the venture community or to the or to industry generally, there better be a market to give you a return. And so to have the government step in and suppress the price, it would really stifle innovation, particularly it wouldn't stifle, I don't think, the research on campus, but it would stifle which products would get picked up, invested in, and taken to market, because you would be unsure if what kind of return you'd be able to get.
So fewer products would make it through.
I think definitely. For those products that the government would step in and require, for example, generics, yes, for sure. It would definitely suppress. In fact, we go through that analysis ourselves already. I mean, if a new drug comes in, or it's not new drugs, it's a new idea for a drug comes in, we evaluate whether the market is big enough to warrant the kind of expense that we, not to mention people we hand it to, are going to be able to take it to market. And if they can't, then we're never going to find the investments to do it. So that evaluation goes on already to compound that problem pretty dramatically by suppressed prices by the U.S. government would have a real deleterious effect on translational into new products, you bet.
We're talking...
I apologize. My dog suddenly decided to chew on a bone next to me.
That's okay.
Thanks.
That's okay. He can be part of the show. So we're talking about the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation with WARF CEO Eric Iverson and Eric's dog. The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation grants millions of dollars annually to UW-Madison to recruit and retain research faculty and grad students. Talk a little bit about how that research funding benefits the state's economy as a whole.
Thanks, Shereen. It is quite remarkable. Just looking at statistics that the campus has put up, almost $31 billion of related startup economic impact on the state. You're talking 92% economic impact benefits the private sector. For every dollar of state funds invested in this fantastic campus, just this campus, not all of the UW system, by the way, $26 returns to the state. So you do that math, and it's just really quite astounding. Billions of dollars in taxes generated, 232,000 jobs supported, 400 plus startup companies. So the economic, as an engine for this economy, it is really quite astounding. I'm very proud to be associated with it, for sure.
Do other states and other universities and states have the same kind of setup, or is Wisconsin unique here?
Many of the states, I mean, of course, we can look at the big research institutions, particularly in the Big Ten, of course, but the economies that truly thrive have to have a big research university embedded within them. And just, you look across from Boston to the Bay Area, to San Diego, Seattle, New York, and then throughout the country, whether it's Austin with UT, University of Texas, or Boulder, of course, with Colorado. And that's in part why Madison, I think in large part why Madison thrives, because of the campus that's here. So in an economy, in a thriving one, and it goes well beyond the city, but into larger geographic regions, they need a big research enterprise to produce these inventions and new ideas.
And where does Wisconsin sit? You know, I mean, how do we compare really to other states? Are we in a leadership role here, or do we have a long way to go?
Well, we're a leader. Wisconsin, as we like to say, punches way above its weight, in the sense of here we sit and in a relatively low population state with this massive university, and we rank currently eighth. I hopefully will jump in those rankings, but of research institutions in the country, we're eighth in total research expenditures at about $1.3 1.3 to 1.5 billion. 1.3 was recent rankings, but I've heard recently that we're as high as 1.5 billion in research dollars spent in a year. It's just astounding how much money goes through this place and the research. And I can attest that it is productive research, because an invention by definition is brand new, right? Brand new. Nobody's thought of this idea before. And we get 400 of those inventions a year from this campus. So the output is phenomenal. And you think about, to the extent we can put even a small fraction of that to work in this state, the jobs, the products, the businesses it supports is quite astounding. We should all be proud. Deeply proud of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and quite frankly, proud of our entire UW system.
Just briefly, we only have about 30 seconds left together, but how do you sift through 400 inventions a year and choose what works and what doesn't?
Well, it's not about what, thank you for the question. It's not about what works and what doesn't. It's about what the patent law says is patentable. And so there may not be sufficient data associated with it. It may not truly be novel. You know, the various rules that you have to comply with for something to be patentable. But we have a team of PhDs and super smart people on staff that then work with the faculty to make those decisions on a monthly basis. It's quite a machine.
It must be. Well, Eric, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Shireen. I really appreciate you having me on.
You bet. Eric Iverson, the CEO of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. I'm Shireen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.